How many of you have read the book Wounded Tiger? I was hoping for less than 20 hands. Excellent. This is a book by T. Martin Bennett. And this book is, in my opinion, an unprecedented look at both sides of the Pacific Theater in World War II. The main character is Mitsuo Fuchida, who, if you know your history, is the commander of the attack on Pearl Harbor. But it also talks about the Americans. Tell a quick story about an American named Jake DeShazer. I think I'm pronouncing that name right. And he is from Madras, Oregon. And he joins the Air Force and becomes a bomber. He sits in the back of a B-29 and he guides the bombs that drop. All right, controls the bombs as they drop. Well, Jake's crew goes on a bombing mission over Japan, and they target a munitions factory. And Jake guides the bombs and zeroes in, and he gets a perfect hit on this munitions factory and blows it up. Also in the story, it talks about a Japanese couple who's engaged to be married, and they fiance, they say goodbye in the morning, or the girlfriend sends her fiance off to work, and later in the day there is a terrible explosion, and she runs outside and she looks off towards town and she sees smoke and debris, and she runs down the road, and her worst fears are realized when she realized that the munitions factory that her fiancé was working at has been hit by a bomb. And she looks around desperately for her fiancé and realizes, after a lot of searching, that he is among the dead. He's been killed in this explosion. Well, Jake's plane has been shot down also. And Jake has been captured by the Japanese. And He's captured, taken to prison, he's tortured, he's starved. But somewhere along the line, there's a guard that feels sorry for him, and this guard gives him a Bible. With nothing better to do, Jake is not a Christian, but with nothing better to do, he reads his Bible, and he reads it again, and he is converted. And he is struck by how unjust the war is. He is touched by the needs of the Japanese people. The war ends, and Jake goes home to Madras, Oregon, and he makes some of his things right, and he goes back to Japan as a missionary to tell his story to the Japanese people. And as he does that, he attracts crowds. People are intrigued. This is an American bomber who's converted, and he cares about us. And people crowd in to see him. He visits the city where this girl lives and where this munitions factory was blown up. And his story is well known at this point, and this girl hears that the bomber who directed the bomb that dropped on this munitions factory and killed her fiancé is giving a talk in this city. And she is still eaten up with bitterness and anger. But she finds out when Jake is coming to her town to give a talk, and finds out where the location is, and she finds a sharp knife, and she hides it in her clothes and prepares herself to stand in line and greet Jake. So that is Wounded Tiger, just one short story from that book.
The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference by Malcolm Gladwell. This is a book about social epidemics, called epidemics because they spread in much the same ways as a disease epidemic. Here's what The Tipping Point has to say about itself on the back cover. The tipping point is that magic moment when an idea, trend, or social behavior crosses a threshold tips and spreads like wildfire. Just as a single sick person can start an epidemic of the flu, so too can a small but precisely targeted push cause a fashion trend, the popularity of a new product, or a drop in the crime rate. I'll soon get to why I think teachers should read this book. This book tells us that there are three main factors responsible for the social epidemics to take off. The author calls these the law of the few, the stickiness factor, and the power of context. The law of the few tells us that there are certain people more responsible for spreading an epidemic than others. The author calls these people connectors, mavens, and salesmen. Connectors know lots of people and make connections. Mavens are people who very closely watch prices or trends. The word maven means one who accumulates knowledge. And salesmen are experts at selling either products or ideas. And all three of these have important parts to play in social epidemics. The second factor is the stickiness factor, how well messages stick. And a message has to stick well if it is to reach epidemic proportions. This chapter talks some about ads and how they can be made more sticky or more effective. The main part of the chapter is about two children's TV shows and the methods used to make them more sticky or effective or memorable. I have to read the chapter to find out more. This chapter does have some good applications for teachers. And then the power of context, the third one, is the surrounding circumstances of an epidemic. Is it possible that dirty subway cars covered with graffiti could make the crime worse in New York City? Or that removing the graffiti and cleaning up the cars could be part of what slowed the crime in the 90s? Read the book to find out more. Also with the power of context is a study where they made a mock prison and had volunteers for the jailers and prisoners. Both of them were acting very differently from normal in a matter of days. So the context or the surroundings made both groups of people act very differently than their normal selves. So again, these three laws. The law of the few deals with the people spreading the epidemic. The stickiness factor is about the actual message or the thing being spread. And the power of context is about how the surroundings play into the picture. To illustrate these three laws, I'd like to mention Paul Revere. Just before the American Revolution, he made a midnight ride to tell settlers of a coming British attack. What made his ride so successful? He knew lots of people and had the right social skills. He had an important message. And the context, the fact that it was at night, added a lot of weight to his message. This is a very interesting book. It seems to get more interesting the farther in you go. Somewhat controversial, maybe. You might not agree with everything. I would say it's tied together very well from the beginning to the end. It does require some concentration to read it, probably not something you're going to just read casually. To me, this book is also about relationships. One part talks about what actually goes on in a conversation. Very fascinating part of the book. Read the book to find out more about that. Another study is what the author calls the magic number 150. That is the maximum number of genuine social relationships you can have. Might be hard to believe. You might know more people than that, but 150 seems to be the limit for close relationships. Also read about one large company that tries to keep all their manufacturing plants to no more than 150 people. Another study in this book talks about trying to replicate the Good Samaritan story and who is most likely to stop and help the victim. Rather sobering. Why should teachers read this book? Well, it has some important applications for teaching. You have to think a little bit to make the application. How can what we have to say be made to stick in students' minds? And how can we as teachers be what we need to be more effective? Again, this is The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. First copyrighted in 2000 by the author. This edition was copyrighted in 2002 and published by Back Bay Books. It's available at various new and used book sources. Or if you live close enough to me, you're welcome to borrow it.
I couldn't stop with one. 10 Peas in a Pod, about the Arnold Pent family, United States, 1940s and 50s.
The father was a man with a very big character, much like in Cheaper by the Dozen. This man was a believer and took his family around the country sharing the gospel. Very notable is the scripture memorization they did. By the age of 6, one of their boys had the entire book of Jonah memorized. Gray matter. The back says, when highly respected neurosurgeon Dr. David Levy decided to ask his patients whether he could pray with them before surgery, he had no idea what to expect. What if the surgery went poorly? What if it went well? Would God or science get the credit? And how would introducing prayer into the surgical process change his patients' and colleagues' opinion of him as a surgeon? Check your library out for that one. It's a great read for high schoolers. A little bit of content that's not appropriate for that setting, you'll have to stay a day or so ahead. The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. How to stay emotionally healthy and spiritually alive in the chaos of the modern world. This book talks about pathological busyness, and it really resonated with me. I think it's a must-read for teachers. Check your library out for that one. The Royal Path of Life, or Aims and Aids to Success and Happiness. This one is an incredible gem from the late 1800s. The writing bears the elegance of that time, and the artwork does as well. Let me read a section to you from the section Life. Never be cast down by misfortunes. If a spider break his web over and over, he will mend it again. And do not fall behind the very insect on your walls. If the sun is going down, look up to the stars. If earth is dark, keep your eye on heaven. With the presence and promise of God, we can bear up under anything. Miracle at Cue Creek Mine. The story of the 9 miners who were trapped 240 feet under Bill Arnold's farm. Bill Arnold is the author. This is a great read for high schoolers. Passion, Purpose, and Prayer. Excellent poetry. It can be yours for $15.75 from Christian Light. The Mote and the Beam, for example. To a darning needle, once exclaimed the kitchen sieve, "You've a hole right through your body, and I wonder how you live." But the needle, who was sharp, replied, "I too have wondered that you notice my one hole when in you there are 100. Tech Talk and Tech Tsunami by Gary Miller. Great reads for sorting through the times in which we live, and great discussion material for high schoolers. Horse Stories from the Man Who Played with Sticks, recommended to me last year at WFTI. I read it to my students last school year. It's incredible what resemblances there are between people and horses. And finally, the Bible in Verse, which is exactly that, every chapter of the Bible written to a 4-line stanza of poetry, all written by a blind man, Alvy E. Ford. Jonah chapter 1. Nineveh's wicked, so Jonah must preach. Wishes to flee from the Lord's mighty reach. Promptly receives the reward for his wish. 3 days vacation inside a great... Chapter 2, Jonah is penitent down in the fish, sees how completely absurd was his wish, promises now to obey God's command, promptly is vomited out on the land.
Good afternoon. It's a privilege to be here and present to you the country of South Africa. As school teachers, it would be quite unaffordable for all of us to fly to South Africa, but the airways of your minds are flying for free today, and so I invite you aboard the Imagination Airlines en route to South Africa. The flight today will only take a few minutes, so hang on and let's enjoy the journey. As the name suggests, South Africa is located at the very southern tip of Africa and is Africa's only first world or developed country. It is about twice the size of Texas and is divided into 9 provinces. We're going to enter the country from the north and fly southwest all the way to Cape Town, which is located right on the southern coast. The first province we enter is Limpopo. Next is Gauteng. Pretoria is the first of 2 cities worth mentioning here, and it serves as the country's most predominant capital. Next is Johannesburg, the capital city of Gauteng. This is South Africa's biggest, most populated city, with around 14.2 million people. South Africans refer to Johannesburg as Joburg for short. Just last month, this city enjoyed a once-in-a-decade snowfall, many children witnessing snow for the first time. The next province we enter is Free State, and its capital is Bloemfontein. Bloemfontein also serves as the country's second capital. It is located at the center of South Africa, and as a point of interest, the country of Lesotho is just off our left and is completely landlocked by South Africa. Now, out in front of us lies the 3 Cape provinces. The Northern Cape to our right, the Western Cape straight ahead, and the Eastern Cape to the left. We are headed for the Western Cape, and we'll prepare for landing in this province's capital, Cape Town. Cape Town is the 3rd and final capital city of South Africa. So why all these capitals? Well, just as our government has 3 branches all in 1 location, this country also has these 3 branches located in 3 separate cities. Pretoria is home to the executive branch and houses the president of the cabinet. Bloemfontein carries the judicial branch, while Cape Town serves as the country's legislative capital and seats the parliament. As we deplane and begin interacting with a few of the 60.6 million people who live in this country, we see quite a variety. Just under 80% of these people are black African, but there's quite a few Caucasians, Indians, Asians, and more. There doesn't seem to be any one language here, but that shouldn't surprise us because this country has 11 official first languages, but the Zulu, Xhosa, and Afrikaans is the most commonly used. The Afrikaans language is actually some type of Dutch dialect stemming back to the times of the colonists. When the Europeans were trading with the Asian countries in the early 1600s, they were sailing around this point in Africa through the Cape of Good Hope. In 1652, the Dutch East India Company established a small provision station right here in Cape Town. Well, as these people usually did, they became established and began to spread. And by the end of the 18th century, the British ruled the country. Then came the racial tension. The whites wanted complete segregation from the blacks and so established the apartheid laws. And this brings us to a man by the name of Nelson Mandela. He was very opposed to the segregation and set about to abolish this system. Because of his involvement in many protests, organizations, and his commitment to his cause, he was jailed for many years. However, in 1992, 4 years after he was released from prison, he became South Africa's first black president. He was committed to reforming South Africa's race relations, strengthening its economy, and establishing its place in the world. Out on the streets, we can still see many signs of the racial history, but people are working hard to heal. At least in most cities here in South Africa, the streets look somewhat depressed, with piles of trash lying around and ugly, high, fortified walls complete with barbed wire and broken glass surround the residents of people with wealth, mainly the whites, staving off the poor criminals who will steal to live, which brings us to the conclusion that we should be careful, especially after dark. So here on the outside, we see the many who are very poor. But if we could get a glimpse on the inside, we would see luxurious homes equipped with many modern conveniences. The people who live here could very well be the ones who are driving this country's economy through mining and other major industries. This country actually leads as the world's largest producer of chrome, manganese, platinum, and more. They also export huge amounts of coal and iron ore. Now, before we get out of the city, I want to take you to the Two Oceans Scenic Helicopter Tours. This flight will include a tour of the city, and then we'll go from the Atlantic Ocean on one side and fly around to the Indian Ocean on the other. There's a lot of other things we can see from the helicopter, everything from great white sharks just off the coastline to beautiful beaches, rolling hills, and rugged cliffs. There's the Table Mountain, which is one of the 7 wonders of the world, and all the other breathtaking scenes of mountain and ocean all in one. If we could get the pilot to fly us high enough, it is possible that we could see the Great Escarpment, which is basically a mountain range that runs parallel to South Africa's coastline. From the Great Escarpment, heading inland is a plateau that ranges from 3,300 to 6,900 feet in elevation. Now, as we travel out of the city, we find a highway system much like our own. It is hard to imagine that just off this major highway, tucked up somewhere in the rolling hills, is a family devout in their Catholic religion, living off of the land, struggling to survive with their single cow or small herd of sheep or goats in their small family farm. Anything extra will be sold at market to buy other necessities. These people can't even afford some of the most basic modern conveniences. Since it is springtime here, we are privileged to witness one of the world's most spectacular display of floral beauty. In the lower elevations, rain comes in the spring months, which are August and September. It is these rains that produce the vast carpet-like stretches of flowers, and it is breathtaking, turning our minds to the Creator. And now, although there are many other things we could do and see, we must take flight. I thank you each for touring with me today, and I want to be the first to welcome you home.
So, close to the end of the year, September, the year 1519, Ferdinand Magellan left his country and began to sail around the world. He actually didn't make it. He's credited as a man who made it the whole way around the world, but he died because he was, he started fighting with people. But before that, he went through a little channel, really super narrow little channel toward the tip of South America that he named because, well, he was the first one to go through it. He called it Straits of Magellan. Went through that October 21, 1520. Thankfully for him, it was kind of springtime, so the weather was more pleasant than it could have been. But as he went through, he noticed there was a bunch of waves, a bunch of wind, a bunch of kind of inclement weather, and through the fog and the mist and the wind and the nastiness, he saw a bunch of fires dotting the shoreline between this really narrow channel that he was on. And he rightly assumed it was the natives, and the natives were, he expected the natives to actually come out and ambush his armada and take him out. So he was going through here terrified in the dark, got through it, and I believe it might have been him, not sure, a little unclear, but he named that area Tierra del Fuego, Land of Fire, for the fires that he saw as he went through there. The natives would build these big bonfires to keep themselves warm. So that's the southern tip of Argentina, which is what we're talking about today, the southern tip of Argentina. If you want to imagine South America, the whole entire chunk of South America, you can imagine that it's just basically a mirror image of North America. So we have North America up here, South America down here. You just kind of fold them in on top of each other, and you get a mirror image. You get a mirror image of the one on the other. So on the western side of Argentina, in South America, you have these great big mountains, the biggest mountains in the Western Hemisphere there. Biggest mountain in the Western Hemisphere is there. It's 2,500 feet taller than Mount McKinley, or Denali, I believe it's currently called. And that would be the mountain Cerro Aconcagua, I believe. My Spanish is not perfect. The southern tip of Argentina is all Patagonian desert and steppe, with an average temperature of just 3 degrees Celsius, or 37 degrees Fahrenheit. So miserable. Comparable, I suppose, to the northern tundra of Canada. And also the Patagonian desert down there in the southern end of Argentina contains the lowest point in the southern hemisphere as well. So we go straight from the highest point to the lowest point. The lowest point in the southern hemisphere is, well, here again my Spanish isn't great, Laguna del Carbón, I'm assuming. It means lake of coal. It's a saltwater lake. It's 105 meters or 344 feet below sea level, so lower than the Great Salt Lake. On the central or eastern part of the country are kind of lower flat rolling plains, similar here again to Nebraska and Kansas. But instead of being bordered by a river, or well, I suppose some of it actually is bordered by a river. The northern part is bordered by a river, but a lot of it is bordered by the Atlantic Ocean. on the east. There are two other things I wish to point out quickly. One of them is that the main language of Argentina is Spanish. The reason that is because back in 1494, just a little bit before Magellan went sailing around and they actually kind of discovered the rest of South America, there was a fight between two countries about who got to keep which parts of South America, and a pope randomly divided South America down a line, and he's like, all right, you guys have the stuff on the east, and you guys have the stuff on the west. Well, it just so happened the Spanish got the stuff on the west, therefore Argentina speaks Spanish. And also discovered just recently, just about 60-some-odd years ago, was something called the Cave of the Hands. This is an art idea for all you teachers. Whip out the spray paint in the classroom would be best because everybody would remember it better. But it was discovered in 1949. They took their hands, they took their hands and just whoosh, spray painted over them. I'm assuming they didn't have spray paint, but it seems to be just a stencil of just hundreds of hands all over the wall of this cave. It's kind of cool. And it was believed to have been done prior to 700 AD, but a little bit unsure how much earlier because of the inconsistencies of carbon dating. So anyway, there you go. Art project from Argentina and the landforms.
So I'm going to do in the country of Mexico. Mexico is a beautiful country with a wide variety of cultures, climates, and topography. Mexico was founded as an independent country from Spain in 1821. The first independence movement was led by two radical priests who lost, but independence was eventually won under leadership of conservative landowners. For most people, Mexico's independence did not change their lives very much. A Spanish elite continued to dominate politics and own the land and mines, while most mixed-race people, called mestizos, labored as artisans and workers, and the indigenous people worked the land for the plantation owners. Many historians refer to the period between the year 1821 and the 1860s as the lost half century. During that period, a small political elite divided between conservatives and liberals fought for control of the government. Conservatives tended to support the old Spanish system of domination by the Roman Catholic Church, the military, and the landlords. Liberals wanted to move to a system of private industry and agriculture, more like that of the United States. Under both liberals and conservatives, and under generals such as Santa Anna, Mexico suffered a series of devastating and almost catastrophic political and military defeats. Most important, between 1836 and 1854, the U.S. took more than half of Mexico's territory, first through the secession of Texas from Mexico and then through the U.S.-Mexican War of 1847. Most U.S. historians agree that these were unprovoked wars of conquest driven by southern states needing more land for cotton. Modern Mexico has a history and culture quite different from our own. Before the arrival of the Europeans, what is today Mexico was inhabited by indigenous people. It is supposed that these indigenous people may have immigrated to the Americas by crossing the land bridge across the Bering Strait many years ago. These indigenous people settled in great numbers in Mesoamerica. That is the region from what is today Panama to about where the city of Zacatecas, Mexico, now stands. These indigenous people learned to cultivate corn and other foods and laid the basis for an agricultural civilization. Some historians believe that as many as 25 million people lived in that region when Columbus landed in the Americas in the year 1492. The Olmecs people of the Gulf of Mexico are considered by many to have been the mother culture of Mexico. The most famous Mexican civilizations were those of the Aztecs in central Mexico and the Mayas of the Yucatan Peninsula and southern Mexico. Some anthropologists and historians compare these civilizations of Mesoamerica, including Mexico, to the great civilizations of the Mediterranean. Mexico is the third largest country in Latin America after Brazil and Argentina, with an estimated population of 130 million. Its official language is Spanish, which is spoken by 90% of the country. The remaining 10% speak a scattering of different dialects that have roots to the Maya and Aztec cultures. Mexican society is characterized by extremes of wealth and poverty, with a limited middle class wedged between an elite cadre of landowners and investors on the one hand and masses of rural and urban poor on the other. But in spite of the challenges it faces as a developing country, Mexico is one of the has one of the chief economic and political forces in Latin America. As its official name suggests, the Estados Unidos Mexicanos, let me pronounce it right, which translates United Mexican States, incorporates 31 socially, Thirty-one socially and physically diverse states and the federal district. Because of the vast instability of the economy and the rampant corruption in Mexico's government and justice system, cartel violence and drug and human trafficking have become a major reality in Mexico. Mexico's cartels dominate the import and distribution of narcotics such as cocaine, fentanyl, heroin, marijuana, and meth. Mexican authorities have been waging a deadly battle against the drug cartels for more than a decade, but with limited success. Thousands of Mexicans, including politicians, students, and journalists, die in the conflict every year. This country has seen more than 360,000 homicides since the year 2006, including gruesome executions done publicly and filmed or posted on blogs and other social media platforms in an attempt at propagating terrorism. Mexican drug cartels are in a constant state of flux. Over the decades, they have grown, splintered, forged new alliances, and battled one another for the territory. The cartels that currently pose the most significant drug trafficking threat include the Sinaloa cartel and the Jalisco New Generation cartel, to name only the two largest groups. There are a score more, but I will not bore you with the mentioning of them. The climate of Mexico. Mexico has more or less four categories of climate division. The first one I will mention is called the tropical wet climate, which has an average temperature of over 64 degrees year-round. Tropical wet precipitates at least 2.4 inches per month, minimum and a high of 15 inches per month during the wetter seasons. The second climate subdivision is known as the tropical wet and dry climate. This climate has a very definite dry season. The dry winter months each typically get approximately 1 inch of rain compared to the 6 or more inches per month that come during the rainy season, which happens during the summer months. Third climate to be mentioned here is the arid or desert climate. As its name suggests, this region is extremely dry with an annual precipitation of 10 inches or less. This region has also experiences frost and freezing weather. Agriculture is very difficult in these areas, except where modern irrigation has been introduced. Finally, we have the dry steppe region with an annual precipitation of 30 inches. The rains fall mostly in the summer, and localized heavy thunderstorms are quite common. This region is substantially better suited for farming, and in my opinion, is a little taste of heaven that less fortunate regions of Mexico so desperately need. Mexico is a very interesting country. There is a vast amount to be learned from the variety of people and cultures and the history of this country, and since I have only scratched the surface, I strongly suggest that each of you go visit Mexico yourself, find out more.